Hi, everybody. My name is Lydia. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lydia.
I am from Arlington, Virginia, and I just drove about 85 miles per hour the last hour because for some reason I thought that this meeting started at 6:30. So when I saw it started at 6, I was like, oh my God! So like, we got here really fast. And, I think that my higher power today is very elegant. And I love that we're using that word about my God, because we got here with 1 minute to spare when my GPS had been telling me for miles that we weren't going to make it until like 10 after 6. And then the road just opened up and there was nobody in front of us and we just flew, you know. So thank you for keeping the cops away from me, dear elegant God, you know, so I could come here. And I am just going to do the best that I can to tell you the truth about me. About what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. The person that I am today is wholly a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am a real alcoholic, just like what the big book describes. I am of the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type. I am one person when I'm sober, and I'm a completely different person when you put alcohol in my system. And I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to do, and when I'm going to stop once I start drinking. And I did not think when I got here that alcohol was my problem. I was 20 years old, and I had been to AA before, actually. I grew up in an alcoholic household. My dad is 12 years sober today. He got sober the day after Christmas. I'll tell you about that later. But so I can say he was an alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and all the joyfulness that comes with that, you know, the not knowing what I'm going to return home to, the distant and communicative mother, everything. We were, you know, good Irish Catholics. We just kept everything swept up underneath the rug. And, you know, I remember my mom would say stuff like, she just really likes to wear black all the time. You know, and that's just the way, sweep, 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 right under the rug. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to look at it, you know. And I came to find out later, you know, that alcoholism is a family disease, and it touches upon everyone who surrounds the sufferer. You know, everybody suffers around the alcoholic. And I just had no idea that my family was sick. It was the only family I ever grew up in, right? So it was only later in my adulthood when I started to learn about what healthy families are that I could see how sick mine was. And so everything was very everything was very surface. There was the way that we presented ourselves out there in public, and then there was the way that we actually were behind closed doors. And I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 8 years old, and I remember that moment like it was yesterday. You know, I think of it as like a romance. It was the first chapter in this great romance that started. And I had felt pretty uncomfortable in my own skin from as early as I can remember, on the playground, feeling like I said the wrong thing and everybody was against me and I just didn't look right, or I was the subject of jokes, or I just was never I was always on the outside looking in, I felt like. And I had lied when I was in, I don't know if you guys remember the show called Punky Brewster. The 80s, yeah. I haven't told this story in a while. You guys are getting it, okay. I told everybody in kindergarten that I was Soleil Moon Frye, the star of Punky Brewster. And they all believed me until one day she did like one of these like primetime specials with I don't know who, Katie Couric or Diane Sawyer, whoever it was at the time was doing things like that. And, you know, her name was Soleil Moon Frye, not Lydia O'Connor. And so the next day, everybody was like, they backed me into a corner. And I remember that. I remember being in the corner and everybody pointing at me, hey, you lied to us, you're not Punky Brewster. And I feel like that really characterizes the way that I felt growing up. I always was that girl that had been backed into the corner and who people were pointing at and saying that I was a liar and that I wasn't what I said I was, and we don't like you. And so I felt in a way like I was ready for that drink at 8 when I took it. And only people like you would understand that. And of course, I didn't become a daily drinker. at that time. But it did start the romance. I knew, you know, what was going to, I had an immediate personality change by just taking a few sips of red wine. And my dad was a college professor. He studied, he was in the classics department. So we spent a lot of time going back and forth. He spent a lot of time going back and forth to Italy. And when I was 8 years old, we got to, me and my brother and my mother got to join him in Florence for about 8 weeks. And there were a lot of college students around. And I was, you know, the cute little kid, and I would manipulate them out of giving me sips of red wine. And I just really, I really loved it. It made me feel like I was a part of something, you know, that I was older than I was, and that I was really on the heartbeat of whatever these people were doing. And so, I mean, the next part of my story is really like when I became a teenager and went to high school. Like, I knew that I would, I knew that there would be drugs there, and I could not wait. I immediately attracted to me the type of person that I wanted to hang out with. Spiritual likes attract, and I sat down right next to one of them in like my freshman year history class, and I don't really know how I graduated that year. I was kind of a nerd, you know. I had been kind of a chubby kid, and I played the flute. I was really good. I was really, really good at playing the flute, actually, and so that's what I did most days. I played soccer. So I'd like go to soccer practice after school, and then I'd walk home, and I'd practice my flute for like hours and hours, you know. I was kind of a dorky kid, and then I found these people that I had always dreamed of finding, and and I started like skipping school, and you know, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used other substances, and I believe from my experience that I used them the same, for the same reason, into the same effect that I drank alcohol. It was just the place that I grew up and the age that I was, it was easier to get some of these other substances so that I could stay out of myself. I needed to be out of myself. By the time I was 16, you know, I had just barely gotten through freshman year. I was dating this guy who looked older than he was, and he had like a fake ID. And I think that was the basis of our love, really. I thought it was something else at the time. I really thought it was real, but looking back, I don't know. I'm not really sure. It was almost immediately abusive. Like, when we drank together, we really drank together. And he also suffered from that personality shift. But the person he became was not a lovely creature. He was very violent. And I stayed in that relationship for the rest of my high school career, basically, for the next like three or so years. I stayed in it, and we stayed drunk. We were drunk, and we were high, and we were just running around. And I would skip school every day. I think phys ed was my first class in the morning, and my second class was supposed to be English, and the classroom that my English class was in looked above the fields, the sports fields. And every day, sometimes I would go to phys ed. I don't know why, because all I would do was antagonize my phys ed teacher. I really had this thing about, I had this whole speech about how the uniforms were degrading, and I would give her this speech. She would get mad. Sometimes she'd send me to the principal's office. But usually I would just leave. I would sneak out the side door and walk across the sports field where everybody in my second period class could see me. And, you know, later that year when I came to them, I had decided to drop out and go to an adult education program called Langston in Arlington. And the Langston program was really for teenage women who had either gotten pregnant or for adults who were trying to finish up their high school degree, who had never done so. But then there was this whole other, what was really happening there was all the kids like me. The kids who, you know, despite the fact that I was drinking and using, I still had an active mind, and I was very intelligent, so I could just figure stuff out, you know. And all those kids, the kids that couldn't do the 5,000 students crammed into a teeny little building that was built for 1,000 students. Like, we just couldn't handle that, you know. So there we all were in this little adult ed program, and I forgot where I was going with that. But, I remember. Part of the withdrawal process at my high school was that I had to take a piece of paper around to all of my teachers, and they had to sign me out of school. I was dropping out of that school and enrolling in this new program. And when I came to my second period teacher, they were like, "Yeah, we see you almost every day. We see you walking across the field." And you know, and one of my biology teachers was like, later after I had dropped out, I got a note in the mail that I suppose she had prepared way earlier, but it basically said, you know, "Your grades are pretty bad, but I believe in you, and I know you can pull them up, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to help you." And I it was like one of those things where I couldn't see it. It's touching to me to think of it now, but at the time I was like, crumple, throw it away, she doesn't understand. And my story is full of people like that, like well-intentioned people who were trying to get me to see this vast potential that I had, and I just couldn't. I couldn't look at that. I couldn't look at myself. And for me, it was like those voices in my head that told me that I wasn't worthy, that I was a piece of crap, that no one would ever love me, that I was disgusting. That's what I heard every time I looked in the mirror. And so I stopped looking in the mirror. You know, I just didn't look at that person because I hated her. I hated that girl. Hated everything about her, you know. So there I was, like, in this adult education program, and we would, we'd have long breaks in between. It was like, I think it was like 4 classes. It was a different kind of schedule, but we'd have long breaks in between classes, and a bunch of us would just go out into the parking lot, pull our cars close up to each other, and like pass the bong back and forth out the windows, and talk and like laugh at how the school officials didn't know what we were doing. Like, we really thought we were like on top of the world, and we were smarter than all of this crap. And I just had this idea in my mind that, you know, I had this endless potential, and one day I would just pull myself up by my bootstraps, and I would have all these things that I wanted out of life, like a college education or a great job, or I don't know why I thought that. I just thought it was all just going to happen, right? It's just going to all fall into place, and I'm going to have it, that I'm not going to have to work for it. I was so burned out, you know, like I could barely speak in full sentences anymore. And thankfully, this program, they had very low expectations, let's put it that way. So if I showed up to class, I got an A for the day. So I ended up graduating with a pretty high GPA. Because the one thing I could do, at that point anyway, was show up for school where the drugs were. And, you know, and this boyfriend of mine eventually ended up coming over to this program as well. And, you know, it had gotten pretty bad. I didn't know this at the time, but looking back on it with inventory and with the experience of having a new, like, squeaky, sober, clean brain, I could see the truth of it, which is that it just, being in a relationship that was abusive, you know, it was physically, mentally, spiritually abusive, it helped me to be a victim. I could justify the way that I lived. Not just the way that I was living, but the way that I thought. The way that I thought about myself, the way that I related to the world. You hit me, and I get to cry about it to all of my friends. This is why I drink, people. It's because this is the only kind of man that a piece of crap like me can hang on to, you know? And my friends are like, "You are crazy. What is wrong with you? Like, you could just walk away, man. Like, so, what are you doing?" You know, it felt very serious to me at the time. And, you know, eventually, he graduated high school and went to Florida to college, and I thought, thank God, you know, I really had convinced myself that that was the only way that this relationship was going to end, was either he was going to leave me or he was going to kill me, because I didn't have it. I didn't have the strength to leave. I just couldn't, you know. I needed that source of drama in my life. By the time I was probably 17, maybe 18, I had become a daily drinker, and that took a lot of skills. It took a lot of skills to be a daily drinker at that age. I stole a lot of booze from my alcoholic father, who kept a well-stocked liquor cabinet, and I kept people close to me that had connections or fake IDs or were also able to steal booze, or I knew the places in Arlington that would sell alcohol to me, either over the counter or bars that I could go to. I was always over at, there was this house that was across the street from where I went to school, and the boy who lived there, like his father basically had like another place that he lived. So he was there almost all the time by himself, and this is where we would all hang out and use drugs, and it was like the most disgusting thing. I remember so many times like waking up, you know, I'd open my eyes and all I would see in front of me was like this field of like orange and white, and things would come into focus and I would see that I had fallen asleep on the carpet, and that all that field of debris was like exactly that. It was debris. It was like bits of Dorito. It was bits of like, it was bits of all kinds of things. And it had ground into my face, you know, and it was all in my hair, and I'd pick myself up and wipe myself off, try and find my shoes, which most of the time I couldn't find. I have no idea what I would do with these shoes, but that was a thing with me. I just lost them all the time. I'd take my shoes off, no idea where they went, probably throwing them at things or people or throwing them out the window, or maybe I kicked them off on my way over. I'm not sure. For a long time, actually, I didn't think that I was a blackout drinker, but that kind of proves it to me because there are big holes in my stories on a daily basis. I don't know what happened. I vaguely recall us trying to push a mattress out a window one night. I have no idea what that was about or why we were doing that. And I would wake up out of blackouts, like making out with my best friend's boyfriend or trying to kiss my best friend. Just, I had no attachment to reality, what was going on. It just was like a bumbling drunk. And oftentimes I needed a babysitter. I would start crying inconsolably. Sometimes I would run down the street screaming and try and throw myself in front of cars. I had a number of suicide attempts when I was a teen, when I was still in high school. I don't know how much of those were real and how much were attempts to get attention. I do know that there were a couple of times that I really would have rather not woken up. One of the times, though, where I just wanted attention, I had skipped school, and a bunch of friends came over, and we were drinking out of my dad's liquor cabinet, and my abusive boyfriend was sleeping with another girl at the time, and I think he had gotten her pregnant, and I was trying to win him back. I was trying to win him back. And so my dad has a heart condition, and I went into his medicine cabinet, and I took his heart medication, because I knew that the way it would work would be my blood pressure would slowly drop, I would pass out, and then I would die, which sounds pretty peaceful. It's just kind of slowly slipping into an oblivious state and passing on. And I was like, that actually sounds really wonderful. I remember having that thought and taking the medicine out, and I remember scooping water into my mouth, but I don't remember anything else. The next thing I recall, I'm running down the street. My sister is behind me on her bike, tears streaming down her face, and I'm screaming, why won't you just let me die? Why won't you just let me die? You know, and someone, a neighbor, had heard me screaming. My sister managed to stop me somewhere near, there's a local park, small park, near where my parents lived, and so she kind of stopped me at the entrance of that park, and someone there heard me screaming, called the cops, and the ambulance arrived, and we're all pretty sure that I didn't actually take any of that medicine, because if I had, I probably wouldn't have still been conscious at that point. But just to be safe, they took me to the hospital and pumped my stomach, which was an awful, awful, horrible experience. And I was not in a blackout for it. Unfortunately, I remember all of it. And my parents, you know, I remember the cop telling my parents, you know, she needs to be in treatment. You really need to put her in treatment. And my parents sweeping it right under the rug. Just want to sweep it all under the rug. We just want to keep it in the family, you know. And that's what my mother said. We're going to keep this in the family. So we started going to family therapy. And that was fun. I remember, like, they brought me home from the hospital, and a couple of hours passed, and I was so restless, you know, restless, irritable, discontent. I couldn't stand it. I could not stand how I felt inside my own skin. And I was like, I'm going out. My parents said, okay, you're going out. You aren't my family. Those people out there are my family. You don't love me. They love me, you know? So there they were confronted with their alcoholic daughter who had just tried to commit suicide and had her stomach pumped. Police are telling them she needs to be committed. And I'm walking out the door, you know? I think I went to go see a guy who, like, totally rejected me that night. I felt awful. Like, I felt like the scum that grows on the back of the pond scum, you know? Just like the worst of the worst. And that wasn't even near the end. That was like the middle, you know? It didn't continue to get worse. It pretty much stayed about the same as that. And this guy, you know, eventually this guy who I had been dating, you know, I did win him back. He's very concerned about me. I won him back, and he went off to college, and I breathed a sigh of relief. He had been institutionalized many times, and one of the conditions of his release was going to AA meetings. And I think that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. The family therapist that we as family had seen, that lasted maybe 6 months. I somehow managed to manipulate my parents, my father especially. I just told him I was doing great. I didn't need to do that anymore. Look at my GPA. Look at all these, you know, other things. I don't even know. I was probably lying, telling him that I was doing other things, like keeping up with soccer, which wasn't true. I was really good at soccer. I may have been good enough to get a college scholarship with soccer. I threw all of that away so that I could smoke drugs. So that I could drink, so that I could smoke cigarettes. I did not want to show up for practice. I just threw it all away. I have no idea how my life might have been different had I not done that. Just to speed things up, I went to my first AA meeting because my very best friend, one of the only people who would still drink with me, got busted. And he had stolen his parents' vehicle and gone off on, like, a binge. He collapsed a lung, smoking crack, got sent before the judge, and the judge said, it's either rehab or jail, and he chose rehab. And I started to go visit him in rehab. And he told me, you know, you're the only person, all these people that said, you know, we're in it for life, man. We're the bestest of friends, man. We're always going to be there for each other, man. None of them showed up. I did, though, because I was terrified. I couldn't lose this one person who was still willing to drink with me. And so I showed up, and, you know, he started telling me the truth. You know, he had had some sort of shift, even after just a couple of weeks of being sober and being inside this program, going to meetings. He'd gotten a sponsor. I think they were starting to work through the fourth step. And he said, you drink just like I do. You know, you drink just like I do. I really think maybe you would benefit from coming to some of these meetings. What do you think? And I was like, I don't think that's true. But I was like, yeah, man, totally. I'll go with you when you get out. And I did. When he got out, I went to some AA meetings. And I picked up like 101 24-hour chips because I couldn't do it. You know, I had the best of intentions. I would come. I was like squarely face-to-face with my own powerlessness over alcohol. I would come to the meeting and I would feel inspired. Like, wow, look at all these people. They're staying sober. They're not doing it. And I don't even know if that's my problem, but, you know, I can at least try. And I couldn't, you know. I would find myself on a Friday or Saturday night at, you know, we're just going to gather together, play a little music. There's no reason to drink at such a gathering. So, you know, someone would show up with a bottle of Jack Daniels and it would come around to me and I would be drunk. And the next day I would wake up cloaked in fear and shame. How did this happen again? You know, missing money, bruises on my body, someone's not talking to me, I'm not sure where my car is, that kind of stuff started happening. And there was my friend, you know, staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd call him up and he would say, you know what, Lydia, I'm not even sure if I can still talk to you because I am really new in this program, and I cannot drink again. I cannot afford to drink again. And I really heard that, you know, like, I felt like he stabbed me in the heart, you know, like, wow, I can't, you know, I'm losing everybody in my life, and I'm out of control. And So I got serious. You know, I started going to AA meetings. Well, I got sort of serious. I was 19 years old. I started going to some AA meetings. I started asking cute boys to be my sponsor. They all said no. They all directed me to their girlfriends or wives who were very, you know, active in the program and whom I should call, who I never did. And someone had given me not the big book, but like a pamphlet that had like a small bit of writing on each step. And I read that and I thought that meant I had done the steps. At this point, I was almost illiterate. It was like, I mean, I could read. I know how to read. But I would look at a paragraph and I might read a sentence and have no idea what in the world it said. So I would, you know, frustratedly read it again. No idea what it said. So I would listen to you. And I would listen to you, what you said that it meant. So your example to me in the beginning was paramount. You know, I needed to hear your experience, strength, and hope because I couldn't get it out of the book. Even when someone sat down and read it to me, I was like, I have no idea I don't know what that means. But listening to that language of the heart, you know, your heart spoke to my heart. Your experience spoke to my experience. And I found something here that I had no idea I was missing. I had no idea that I longed for, that I had been looking for. It felt like a homecoming in a lot of ways. And I didn't stay sober. I stayed sober doing it on my own. I played a lot of laser tag at night. I mean, everybody at the laser tag place knew me. You know, hey, Lydia, how many games tonight? You know, I just played a lot of laser tag and went to meetings. And I met a guy, you know, my best friend who had taken me to the AA meeting. His brother, one of his brother sponsees, was this guy from Lexington, Virginia, who was up in Northern Virginia doing some work, and it was like love at first sight, you know, like really like innocent, kind of we're gonna build this great life together and we're gonna do it sober, and I couldn't really see it for what it was for a long time. But he had consequences from his drinking. He'd gotten himself in big trouble down in Southern Virginia, and they put him in jail for a really long time. He allegedly hit somebody over the head with a hammer after robbing him, and they put him in jail for like 13 years. And my heart was totally broken. Oh my God, sorry. Messing around with my phone, and I'm turning my music on. Is that down? where's that music coming from? It's me. I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, I was 20 years old, and I had never really explored a relationship with a higher power. I was not an atheist. I would really have loved to have been one because I thought that was super cool. And I like to tell people that I was one, but I wasn't. You know, I did believe in something. I believed in a power that was greater than me. And I believed that it permeated all things and that it was a part of me as well. My father was a man of faith, you know, despite his alcoholism. Before he met my mother, he was in seminary. He wanted to be a priest. And he would have been a great priest. He's got such a loving, wise, open heart. And forgot what I was saying again. Totally went blank. I have no idea where I was in my story. What? Oh, yeah. Sorry. Thank you. I had never explored this relationship. I know now we have a chapter called We Agnostics, and that's what I was an agnostic. I believed that there was a God, but that this God had absolutely no interest in me, that I had done things that were terrible and unforgivable. And really, like, there were so many of us on the planet. Why would a God care anything about me or what I did? You know, I couldn't even look at myself in my own mirror. I couldn't look at my own image. Why would this God care about me? And you know, so I placed all that dependency and all that hope and all that expectation and all that power in other people. And when this particular person left my life, I was crushed. You know, I had no idea how I was going to go on living. And I went on living by drinking. I got right back in the bottle, you know. We intensely loved each other, and I ended up getting pregnant, and I made a decision to have an abortion because I couldn't imagine my life, you know, the daughter of a college professor having a baby daddy in prison. Like, I couldn't do it, you know, I just couldn't, and I had no idea, like, how long he was going to be in there, when he was going to get out, and, like, how was I ever going to go to college and do all these things, and I made that decision, and sober, I couldn't stand it. I would put my head down on the pillow at night, and all of those things would flash through my mind about how despicable and horrible I was, and how I had defied God this way, and I couldn't do that. I drank, you know, I drank, and it was a horrible, horrible 3 months of just complete oblivion. That's all I wanted. Couldn't stand myself. I just wanted to be as far away from me as I could possibly be. And that same friend who had taken me to my first AA meeting, who had gone before the judge, and the judge said, jailer AA, he came back to me, and he was like, well, you know, I really need a ride down to this meeting. It was one day in May. I really need a ride down to this meeting in DuPont Circle in D.C., can you take me? You didn't have a car. I was like, oh, I don't like D.C. It's so scary around there. Like, what if I can't find my way out? I'll just go with you to the AA meeting. He was like, great. And that ended up being my home group. I walked in to this church basement in DuPont Circle, 21st and P Street, my home group, the Midtown group. And it was full. It was like 150 people at the time or something like that. It was full of all these young people. And somehow they immediately knew that I was new to the group. And I couldn't talk, you know. I'd just look at the floor and I would giggle and smile and, ha-ha, yeah, how are you? I don't know. And this one, you know, all these women, I think at the time somebody had just gone on a trip to the Pacific group, and they brought back this short-lived tradition of all the women have to get dressed up for the meeting. So all the women were in these, like, sunny, you know, these sundresses. They looked all pretty. They'd pretty done their hair and their little shoes and stuff, and I did not look like that. And I certainly didn't feel like that. So I didn't relate. I told myself I didn't relate to any of them, you know, and this one woman came up to me when the meeting was over, and everybody was kind of filtering out and stuff. She came up to me and introduced herself, and I don't know why. I asked her, I was like, how do you do this? You know, how do you do this? There's so many people. She was like, find a couple of people that you relate to or you trust, and you put yourself in their back pocket. You just do what they do. And she was wearing paint-spattered overalls. I found out later because she was painting that day and, like, didn't have time to change into the requisite sundress or whatever. So I was like, will you be my sponsor? Because I thought her outsides matched me a little bit better than those other women. And she ended up being my sponsor for 8.5 years, for the first 8.5 years, until she eventually drank again. But I needed the kind of sponsorship that she was offering to me at the time. She scared the absolute bejesus out of me. She was very strict. You know, I called her every day, and she yelled at me. where were you? I'd be at the meeting. You have to be there half an hour before it starts, and you need to stay a half an hour after it ends. It's the meeting before the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. It's very important. And I had to go to all these, like, you know, when someone celebrates a year, we do a watch the night before. We hang out with them. We watch them get sober until midnight. I had to go to all of those stupid watches. I was terrified of people. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't talk. I couldn't look people in the eye. It, like, felt like when I was around people, I couldn't sit down. I'd always be standing up. I couldn't talk to people. So afraid. Always looking at the floor. Never smiling. Smiling was a sign of weakness where I came from. And so I didn't do that. But people just loved me anyway. You know, they kept saving seats for me, and they kept inviting me to things and offering to pick me up because I liked to have control. I wanted to drive everywhere. People would offer, you know, all sorts of things. And what ended up happening for me was, just like the Big Book describes, I needed to have that vital concession. I needed to concede to my innermost self that what I had was alcoholism, and that the only solution that was viable for me for that problem was going to be Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to believe that all roads led to jails, institutions, and death, or AA, you know? And I hit a sober bottom by being what I later learned was self-overrun riot. I rebel in the face of authority. I do it today. I have to be really careful about that. Yeah, I don't want you to tell me what to do. I became the page 37 in the 12 and 12, where it talks about, you know, as far as my drinking and alcohol is concerned, you people can advise me, but the rest of my life, that's me. That's me. I get to run that show. And what I found was that I was taken down by the juggernaut of self-will, which is exactly what it describes. And what really got me was that I was about to, my sponsor and her roommates were all sober. They would have a women's meeting at their house every other Tuesday night, which I had been going to for the whole first year of my sobriety. One night, I was supposed to go to that meeting, and I wanted to go get drunk. I felt it in my bones. I wanted to go get drunk. And it felt like a compulsion that I had no power over. I had no power over it at all. It's scary to think about it now, actually, because I had nothing had happened. There was no reason for me to want to drink like that. I had a boyfriend who was sober in the program. We were making plans for a future. Someone in AA had given me this incredible job that someone like me could never have gotten on their own. I was making money. I had all the outside things, right? I had friends now. My relationship with my family was strained, but it was on the road to getting better. And then I wanted to drink so fucking bad, you know? My feet took me to my sponsor's house for the women's meeting. And my hand, without my permission, raised, and I told these people the truth, you know, what I had really been doing with my time, how I'd been really living. I told them all my secrets. And this woman came up to me afterwards, and she was like, here you go, hand me the 12 and 12, page 37. And what got me in that moment was the paragraph that says, if his own image in the mirror was too painful to bear, and I knew, I can't look at myself in that mirror. I hate that girl. How did they know this? This was written in 1950. Whoa, you know? It was that moment I conceded. I had a spiritual shift. I had a spiritual experience in that moment. It makes me emotional to think about it, actually, because I didn't do that. I didn't shift something. There was nothing that I could have done to shift that. There was something entered me and relieved that compulsion to drink and put me at ease, you know, like, this is it. You are in the right place. This is where you belong. These are your people. This is your malady, you know? What are you going to do with it? And I jumped right in. I jumped into the middle. You know, I had this this AA boyfriend who was like Mr. AA. He did all the stuff, you know, ran all the dances. He started meetings. He, you know, worked as a sponsor and was sponsoring guys. But he was doing all the stuff, you know? So I kind of, in a way, jumped in his back pocket because I still didn't have that solid relationship with a higher power of my own. Even though God was clearly right there working for me, for my benefit. And we ended up getting married. I was 2.5 years sober. I was 23 years old. We got married, and I was happy for a minute, and then I wasn't. Yeah. It never even occurred to me that 23 was a bit young to be getting married. And I couldn't see past the wedding day. I really wanted all that attention, you know, and then they came and went, and now what? You know, I've got to live this life with this man. Like, now I'm in a marriage. And it was so freaking boring. I didn't know that at the time. This is looking backwards with wisdom and experience, you know. I can see that I was bored out of my mind, and it's really not a good idea for an alcoholic to be bored because I start plotting sabotage. I'm a master saboteur. I love to burn the bridge before I cross it because that's interesting. It's interesting and fun. It means that there's something happening, and I get to be a part of it and, you know, help dive in there and solve it or whatever, survive it, you know. And so that's exactly what I one day, we've been married about 3.5 years, and one day he came home. He was so happy, you know. I'll never forget it. And I was like, you need to sit down. He's like, Seth, sit down, yeah? What's happening, honey? And I was like, I don't love you anymore, and I'm leaving. And I just stood up from the table, got in my car, and drove away. And it was a callous, cold thing to do at the time. And I had And that's the way that I was, you know. Like I still needed to do these steps with a full and open heart, with a higher power at my back. I needed to really tap into that emotional side and to be able to have that kind of compassion for another human being. And I couldn't. I was so self-centered and deep into my own selfishness. I needed to do what I needed to do for me. And in the end, that ended up being a blessing for him and for both of us, really. I finally got honest. I was finally being honest. You know, the truth about me was that I didn't want to be married. You know, I was 27 years old. I didn't want to be married. I didn't want to be a housewife. And I just didn't. You know, I wanted to. I felt like I had never had a. I spent my childhood drinking. You know, I wanted to live. I didn't know that, but that's what was happening. And as a result. You know, that was one of the most painful experiences of my life, and it wasn't because I was getting divorced. That was the circumstances. That was what was happening on the outside. But what was truly difficult was having a spiritual revolution, a revolution of the way that I looked at the world. I really had to go back through and do the fourth step again and clear away some of that that anger that I had towards the world. To really look at it and let it go and start to investigate my part, what was really my part in all of this anger that I had held for so long. And what do you do when, I mean, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat for months. I felt so lost, you know. I had nothing to place that power in, and I had this little Boston Terrier that I had gotten, this little dog named Bodie. And, you know, I was living with sober people. 4 o'clock in the morning, we were living out, you know, in Fairfax County, where it's nice and quiet and dead quiet. Couldn't sleep. 4 o'clock in the morning, nobody to call. I feel like blowing my brains out. My head is so loud. My thoughts are pinging around the room. You know, I had no choice but to pray, to reach out to this power that everybody else told me they were intact with. You know, and so I did that. I had heard somewhere that dogs and babies, or animals and babies, are closer to God. So I, you know, had this little Boston Terrier, and I was like, "Hey, Bodie, can you pass a message on to God for me?" And I swear to you, she was like, "Yes," you know. She would just stop what she was doing. She would lick obsessively, and she would just be like, "You have a message for God, do you? What is it? What is it? Give me." I swear to you. I know that sounds crazy, but to me at the time, that's what worked for me, and I would talk to God through my dog, and it seemed like she was really listening, and slowly that turned into something else. Like, before I knew it, like, when I, you know, I had quit that amazing job and had gone back to college, and I was really having a hard time at that time showing up for school, and that's what, you know, AA, that's what AA taught me. When my sponsor was like, "You need to show up at the meeting a half an hour early and stay a half an hour late," she was giving me skills. She was teaching me how to show up for my life. And that was one of the very first spiritual principles that she ever handed to me, was do what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it. And that was certainly not just for inside the AA room. That was supposed to apply to my life, you know, showing up for a job, showing up for school, showing up for my family. That's just really hard when you're selfish and self-centered like I am. You know, I want to do what I feel like doing. And what I feel like doing right now might not be what I feel like doing later. I was really ruled by my emotions. And so I was having a hard time showing up at school. And I would, you know, I would get dressed and I'd go for the door and be like, "I can't do it." And I'd go for the door and be like, "I can't do it." You know, so I'd hit my knees, and I've, like, never in my life had prayed on my knees before, you know, and so I'd hit my knees and be like, "Please, God, like, please give me the strength to walk out this frickin' door and go to class," you know, and sometimes I would, and sometimes I couldn't, you know, sometimes I just couldn't, but we got through that time together. You know, I had, like, an army of AA women at my back helping me to do what I needed to do and giving me emotional support and taking my phone calls really late. And I would drive around all over the D.C. metropolitan area picking people up for meetings. Sometimes I would go to 3 meetings a day because I was just so nuts, you know. And eventually that started to pass where I actually felt, like, strong and confident in my own skin, confident with this power that I had tapped into for the first time in my life, you know. I started to wonder, who am I and what do I want to do? What do I want to do with this new lease that I've been given, you know? Everything is possible. Everything is possible. So I, with the help of my sponsor, I decided that I would apply to graduate school, and I ended up going to Ireland. I went to Trinity College in Dublin, which is just a stone's throw away from my Mecca, which is the Guinness Brewery. And I never found an occasion to visit, but I did pass by it many times, and I did not have to drink Guinness. I lived there for 3 years, and I made amazing lifelong friendships with women that I was privileged to sponsor. There wasn't a lot going on there for the young people, and so I did what I had been taught to do, what the big book tells me to do. I created the fellowship that I craved. I started cinema nights, you know, where we'd go to an earlier meeting and then go out to the movies afterward. We'd started doing dances, and like they had never done a dance in Dublin before. Everybody thought it was so lame. But then they would all be like, well, we're going to do another one, you know? Can I maybe help out when you do the next one? You know, and like one dance, like a Christmas dance turned into a, we needed a spring dance, and then we also needed a Halloween dance, and then, you know, we were coming up with excuses to do more and more stuff. We did a Founders Day event. We started doing it because Ireland has a different Founders Day than we do. So we started doing a Founders Day event for them, and I started sponsoring all these women. And it really, you know, taking women through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and, like, that language of the heart, it doesn't matter where you are, that is what resonates. You know, the first thing I did when I got off the plane, I was terrified. I hadn't thought about it. I just put in the application, and I just packed my bag, I just bought my ticket, I just sent in the money, you know. When I got off the plane, I was like, oh, my God, what did I just do? I just moved to a foreign country. I don't know anybody. So I went to an AA meeting, and I raised my hand, and I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I just moved here. I'm going to college. I need a service position, and if anybody needs a sponsor, I have plenty of time to sponsor people. And someone asked me to be their sponsor that night, and they made me the tea server, so serving the tea at this meeting. And so I just jumped right in the middle, and that was my responsibility. I can't just wait around for someone to come knock on my door and say, hey, I heard you were sober. Like, I got to jump right in the middle and tell people what I need, you know, ask them for what I want and what I need. And I ended up meeting a really cute guy in the meeting, and he was sober a couple of years and totally enthusiastic and very attractive. And we started dating, and before I knew it, like, we got married in a fever, you know, that I was only supposed to be there for a year on a student visa, and, you know, I didn't put any pressure on him, and that is true. I really didn't. But we, like, were in crazy love, and we couldn't imagine not being with each other. So we got married in a castle in the Irish countryside, and everyone was so happy for us, and then everything changed. He's an alcoholic. He has alcoholism, just like I do. And I learned from my first marriage that if I'm not diligent about my spiritual condition, that I'm going to start acting out, and I'm going to start pushing people away and behaving in a way that people don't want to be around, you know, and that's essentially what happened. And the sicker that he became, the sicker I went with it. I followed him down that rabbit hole on a different plane. You know, the program of Al-Anon is basically a different side of the same coin. And I became more controlling and more possessive, and I needed to know where he was, who he had talked to, and what he was doing. And eventually what happened was he had been cheating, and I thought that the best solution to this would be to move back to America, you know, that I needed my support, I needed my family. And what I really thought was that he needed American AA, that if he came over to the AA that I had gotten sober in, that he would get better, right? In fact, the opposite happened, that he didn't get better. He just, I think he got better at faking it. I don't know if that's fair to say, but we managed to last about a year after we had moved back here, and then one day he left. You know, we had gone back to Ireland to visit, and he had some sort of psychotic breakdown. And I think I came to speak here at this group a couple of days after I had found out what was really going on. I didn't know. You know, I thought, is he using drugs? Is he, in fact, his mother had had him drug tested when we were over there. I didn't know that, but she was suspecting something was going on too. just wasn't the same person that he had been, and I couldn't control it. I couldn't control him. I didn't know what to do. I had become crazy. I had become secretive, and I was really in food. I gained all this weight, and I felt horrible about myself and ashamed, and like I didn't want anybody to know what was really going on. And then he had this psychotic breakdown. I thought he was going to hurt me, you know. So I jumped on a plane, came back to America, and he told me to move out. And so I did. I packed up my stuff, moved out of our apartment, completely baffled what was going on. And then I found out right before I came to speak here, actually 3 years ago, that he had been having an affair with another woman in my home group, and I was totally devastated, you know. All the other stuff, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know if I need to know. I don't know if he was using. I don't know what was happening. But I know that it was really crazy and it was really dangerous. And it completely devastated me and my family emotionally and financially. I was in big trouble. All the debt was in my name because he was an Irish citizen. And his school loans, his car, our credit cards, like, everything was in my name. And then I also found out that he had taken out additional credit cards in my name that I didn't know about. So there I was, you know, like fighting this like bad man, you know, for just to be free, and wanted to divorce him. And he was giving me hell about it. And I thought I was so stressed out. I thought I was going to die. I was double digit sobriety and I was sponsoring all these women. People were looking to me and I knew that the one thing that I could count on was you and the higher power that you represent. You know, when I come into this room, I immediately tap into something that is, it's an energy, it's a force. I come here, and just like drinking a shot of whiskey, I can suddenly breathe again. I can relax a little bit, my shoulders drop. You know, I'm all right, I'm safe. That sense of homecoming returns, you know, that I had the spiritual malady that was churning inside of me, and it felt like homesickness. It felt like I had been ripped away from something that was so comfortable. And then when I come back here with you, that homesickness is relieved, you know. That sense of terrible grieving, that sense of terrible guilt. I'm with you for just a few minutes, and that's all gone, you know. I'm reminded of how lucky I am, how much gratitude I get to have in my life, how my whole life today has been built on a foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, living a life of principle, living a life of dignity, living a life of service, you know, that you have given me everything that I have, you know. My father got sober, my first husband, who, you know, I was bored with and didn't love. My husband picked my father up off the floor, dusted him off, and took him to his very first AA meeting. And when I was so resentful at him, for God knows why, that's what I focused on. I was like, because of him, because of that mistake I made, I have a sober dad today. That first husband took me on a honeymoon to Ireland. And I got to focus on, because of him, I went to Ireland, and something inside of me woke up, and I knew that I needed to go there. You know, and because of that second husband, I got to stay in Ireland longer. I got to see all of that country. I got to learn all of that history about Ireland and about my family and where I come from and my heritage. And I got to sponsor all of those women and help those seeds, water those seeds inside of them. And there's a speaker out in California, and she says, sometimes you never know when you throw a little pebble into the lake, you know, and the ripple that goes out. You may never see that ripple hit the shore. But I know today through Facebook and other things that these women are still sober, and they're sponsoring other women, and we're in contact on a weekly basis, you know, and they're like soul sisters for me. You know, so that husband and I, we did end up getting divorced, and that was 3 years ago. I never thought that I would make it through that. I just have another minute. Oh, no, I don't, actually. I'm supposed to be over now. But I ended up having to file for bankruptcy, and that was one of the most humiliating things I've ever had to do in my sobriety. I was 13 and a half years sober, and I thought, I need to fix this. I need to make this right. But I couldn't, you know. It was impossible. And I went back through the big book, and I saw in there that it says I just had to be willing to face my creditors. And that's that what opened my eyes was like a neon flashing, you know, thing in the big book that I had to be willing to face my creditors and to face them with the truth. And the truth was I couldn't pay all this debt that I had been left in. So I filed for bankruptcy. And since then, you know, my life is actually better than it's better than it's ever been. I don't have any of the things that I thought I was going to need in order to feel happy and comfortable in my own skin. You know, I've been single for almost 3 years. I've been finding out who I am. What do I love about life? You know, and I've gotten to travel all over the place. And I, you know, met with the Dalai Lama. I went on retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh. I've done stupid things, all sorts of stupid things that I thought were really fun, like running with the bulls. And and I've got to do a lot of reading, and I've gotten to learn how to be self-supporting. You know, I finally, you know, I had to ask for my parents' help after that happened, and I finally got my own place this year, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And I have not a cent to my name, but I am totally self-supporting. And I feel more comfortable and more happy than I ever have. I sponsor women. I'm a member in good standing of my home group. And that's what gives my life purpose and meaning today, that I have this big, huge, elegant, enormous God that no matter what happens is always going to be there by my side, even if I don't like it, you know? Even if I don't like what's happening, it's okay. It's going to be okay, you know? So anyway, thank you so much for having me out here and for letting me speak. Thank you.